Hello, this is Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest. And the National Interest, thank you for joining again to listen to three questions. I'm really excited to be here today with my colleague at the Center for the National Interest, Joshua Yaffe. Josh is a senior fellow working on the Middle East at the center and spent 15 years at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research as their lead analyst covering the Arabian Peninsula. Josh, thanks a lot for joining. I want to talk to you today about the crisis that's been unfolding, the conflict, I guess I should say, that's been unfolding in the Middle East. First, Israeli airstrikes on Iran, followed by U.S. attacks on three of Iran's nuclear sites. And I know that you wrote, I think, very perceptively in early April, foreseeing a possible strike about some of the potential impacts from that. You did predict at that time, for example, you know, that it was sort of unlikely to stop Iran's long-term pursuit of a nuclear weapon, to dampen Iran's regional belligerence, or to topple the Islamic Republic. Do you stand by that assessment? What do you think the impacts of the strikes on Iran have been so far?
Thank you so much, Paul, and thank you for having me. I think that the debate right now in the media is all about whether there was a sufficient level of destruction of the Iranian program to set it back for a matter of months or a matter of years. But that's not really thinking long term. And some of the long term outline of what's going to happen in the region is already pretty clear. There is a new status quo, and you can't return to the old status quo. What does that new status quo look like? I mean, we're going to see in the coming weeks what Israel wants to do to shape its relationships in the region as a result of all of this. But I think a few things are certain. One is that moving forward, Israel and the U.S. will now bomb Iran at will whenever they determine there is an imminent threat. What does imminent mean? It means whatever Washington and Jerusalem want it to mean. That was the outline and the contour of the 12 days of fighting, was that the Europeans are not going to stand in the way. The United Nations isn't going to call America to task over its involvement in what it's doing. And so it's really up to the United States and Israel to decide what is an imminent threat. This is not the same at all as 2001 through 2003, when we had to go to the United Nations and plead our case and make a convincing statement as to why we want to do intervention in the way we want to do it, where we want to do it. It's a new normal in the region. And if Iran retaliates, Iran can expect a much more intense and expansive military campaign in response. So this is part of the new normal. Another part of it is that Iran's proxies in the region are no longer its proxies. We should no longer expect Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, the Hashar al-Shaabi in Iraq to operate together in any way, shape, or form. The new normal should be expecting them to operate on their own and solely according to their local interests. And we shouldn't expect Iran to commit the same level of resources to these groups the way it did before. It has no reason to. It has no reason to expect a return on that pay. They may coordinate in certain ways, but that would probably be more of the outlier than the normal, I would expect. Other countries in the region are more likely to move closer to Israel. You could imagine Syria conceivably normalizing relations. There was talk in the Israeli press that they've got an envoy communicating with the Syrians about the possibility of that right now. Other countries are unlikely to do that. Saudi Arabia is not going to normalize anytime soon. But you can imagine other countries like Saudi engaging in more public forms of defense and security cooperation. Other aspects of the new status quo. There are states in the region that safely avoided entanglement in the last 2 years of conflict. I'm thinking specifically about Iraq. But you can also throw in Syria and a couple other places. I would imagine part of the new normal is Israel and the United States engaging those countries almost as a reward for their ability to stay out of the fighting, but also as a way of isolating Iran. There's going to be a big effort by Israel to build a coalition, to build an alliance, to further isolate Iran diplomatically, financially, et cetera. And part of that's going to be outreach to places like Iraq as a reward for their ability to keep their militias under control. And I think one of the big consequences of all this is the United States is going to pull resources out of the region. I think this finally allows the United States to begin a bit of a pivot in ways they've wanted to do the last few years but haven't fully accomplished. It's not a complete withdrawal from the region, but I would imagine that we will find excuses for moving certain numbers of forces away, entrusting that there'll be more regional support for keeping Iran locked in.
Let me turn to my second question here. President Trump, of course, started on this pathway trying to negotiate with Iran and to come up with some kind of new version of the Iran deal. He continues to say that he wants to negotiate, that he wants peace. Do you see some kind of new U.S.-Iran agreement in the cards?
The Islamic Republic will die on the hill they've chosen to die on. They're not going anywhere. Any compromise, any accommodation signals weakness to their own people and opens them up to all sorts of chaos on the streets. It's an uncontrollable process if you start to open up your country to dialogue on a political level. What's happened's happened. Iran will want to continue building a nuclear program. I think as a number of Israeli analysts were saying over the last few months, it will be highly expensive for Iran to do that. And Iran is not in a good position in terms of its knowledge base with all these scientists killed and in terms of its finances to massively rebuild its nuclear program. But it will try. And the leadership of the Islamic Republic may negotiate. But I think in their minds, they've survived and they've survived to fight another day. What you're really looking at, I would imagine, is the same situation that we were in 1991 with Saddam Hussein. And that, in a sense, is the worst of many worlds. Yes, it was important to destroy Iran's nuclear program. It was important to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. But what you're looking at over the next few years is a regime in Tehran that doesn't want to go anywhere, doesn't want to reform, cracks down on its people even harder because it will face immigration, brain drain, protests in the streets. It will have to conduct mass arrests, which it's already doing right now, of people that are supposed Mossad agents. It will expand that into show trials. And the international community doesn't have much of a way to influence that situation, just like it was with Iraq in the 1990s. You can do international isolation. You can do sanctions. You can even do no-fly zones. But they're not going to bring down a regime that doesn't want to be brought down. And so you're stuck in limbo with this problem that won't go away and can't be influenced. And a lot of people in Washington then regretting, perhaps, that more wasn't done when the chance was available.
Third and final question, and maybe here we can take a little bit of a step back and look at some of our geopolitical rivals and their roles in the region. There's been a lot of concern in the United States kind of about Russia's role, you know, starting with the Russian intervention in Syria. And of course, Russia had to abandon Assad, you know, in his hour of direst need, in no small part due to their very extensive commitments in Ukraine. Russia did not really materially come to the aid of Iran during this very dark time for Iran. And China, of course, has been pursuing a very different approach in the region, you know, of extensive economic engagement. Some have been kind of worried, you know, that the U.S. is disengaging or uninvolved or unlikely to play a major role in the region. How do you think this affects the geopolitical competition? How do regional states, you know, look at these kind of three key players in the wake of this event?
It's a very important question right now because there was a lot of back and forth, apparently, in the White House from everything you read about the president's decision whether to do this or not to do this. I suspect, I don't know, but I imagine that part of the logic that went into it among senior officials was carrying this out in the way they carried it out without consulting other allies or partners around the world, and then not caring what they thought afterwards, was done in such a way to send a signal to other parts of the world that this is what you can expect from the United States, and it's a good thing, it's not a bad thing, but you're going to have to adjust your expectations as to what you then do, China vis-a-vis Taiwan or Russia vis-a-vis other parts of Eastern Europe. It sends a signal that the Trump administration is going to act quickly and decisively and unilaterally if and when it wants to. And that's going to have to make other countries stop and pause before they take actions. I suspect that's what this administration was looking for. Okay, the effect of it all, Fordo or not Fordo, it was a symbolic target that could symbolize a lot of other things to other parts of the world in ways that matter for this administration over the next 4 years. And I think they'll be successful in that regard.
Terrific. Thank you again. This is Paul Saunders on the Three Questions podcast with the Center for the National Interest. The National Interest, I've been talking to my colleague, Joshua Yaffe. Josh, thanks for a really terrific conversation on some really important issues.